Youth, Conversion, and First Labors of Luther. Chapter 3. His Father's Anger. Luther was with God at last. His soul was in safety. He was now about to find that holiness which he so much desired. The monks were astonished at the sight of the youthful doctor, and extolled his courage and his contempt of the world. He did not, however, forget his friends. He wrote to them, bidding farewell to them and to the world, and on the next day he sent these letters, with the clothes he had worn till then, and returned to the university his ring of Master of Arts, that nothing might remind him of the world he had renounced. His friends at Erfurt were struck with astonishment. Must so eminent a genius go and hide himself in that monastic state, which is a partial death? Filled with the liveliest sorrow, they hastily repaired to the convent, in the hope of inducing Luther to retrace so afflicting a step, but all was useless. For 2 whole days they surrounded the convent, and almost besieged it, in the hope of seeing Luther come forth. But the gates remained closely shut and barred. A month elapsed without anyone being able to see or speak to the new monk. Luther had also hastened to communicate to his parents the great change that had taken place in his life. His father was amazed. He trembled for his son, as Luther himself tells us in the dedication of his work on monastic vows addressed to his father. His weakness, his youth, the violence of his passions, all led John Luther to fear that when the first moment of enthusiasm was over, the idle habits of the cloister would make the young man fall either into despair or into some great sin. He knew that this kind of life had already been the destruction of many. Besides, the Councilor of Mansfeld had formed very different plans for his son. He had hoped that he would contract a rich and honorable marriage. And now all his ambitious projects are overthrown in one night by this imprudent step. John wrote a very angry letter to his son, in which he spoke to him in a contemptuous tone, as Luther informs us, while he had addressed him always in a friendly manner after he had taken his Master of Arts degree. He withdrew all his favor, and declared him disinherited from his paternal affection. In vain did his father's friends, and doubtless his wife, endeavor to soften him. In vain did they say, "If you would offer a sacrifice to God, let it be what you hold best and dearest, even your son, your Isaac." The inexorable counselor of Mansfeld would listen to nothing. Not long after, however, as Luther tells us in a sermon preached at Wittenberg, January 20, 1544, the plague appeared, and deprived John Luther of 2 of his sons. About this time someone came and told the bereaved father the monk of Erfurt is dead also. His friends seized the opportunity of reconciling the father to the young novice. "If it should be a false alarm," said they to him, "at least sanctify your affliction by cordially consenting to your son's becoming a monk." "Well, so be it," replied John Luther, with a heart bruised, yet still half rebellious. "And God grant he may prosper." Some time after this, when Luther, who had been reconciled to his father, related to him the event that had induced him to enter a monastic order, "God grant," replied the worthy miner, "that you may not have taken for a sign from heaven what was merely a delusion of the devil." There was not then in Luther that which was afterwards to make him the reformer of the church. Of this his entrance into the convent is a strong proof. It was a proceeding in conformity with the tendencies of the age from which he was soon to contribute his endeavors to liberate the church. He who was destined to become the great teacher of the world was as yet its slavish imitator. A new stone had been added to the edifice of superstition by the very man who was ere long to destroy it. Luther looked to himself for salvation, to human works and observances. He knew not that salvation cometh wholly from God. He sought after his own glory and righteousness, unmindful of the righteousness and glory of the Lord. But what he was ignorant of as yet, he learned soon after. It was in the cloister of Erfurt that this immense transformation was brought about, which substituted in his heart God and his wisdom for the world and its traditions, and that prepared the mighty revolution of which he was to be the most illustrious instrument. When Martin Luther entered the convent, he changed his name and assumed that of Augustine. The monks had received him with joy. It was no slight gratification to their vanity to see one of the most esteemed doctors of the age abandon the university for a house belonging to their order. Nevertheless, they treated him harshly, and imposed on him the worst occupations. They wished to humble the doctor of philosophy, and to teach him that his learning did not raise him above his brethren. They imagined, besides, by this means to prevent him from devoting himself so much to his studies from which the convent could reap no advantage. The former master of arts had to perform the offices of porter, to open and shut the gates, to wind up the clock, to sweep the church, and to clean out the cells. Then, when the poor monk, who was at once doorkeeper, sexton, and menial servant of the cloister, had finished his work, "Come sacco precipitatum. Away with your wallet through the town," cried the friars, and laden with his bread bag, he wandered through all the streets of Erfurth, begging from house to house, obliged perhaps to present himself at the doors of those who had once been his friends or his inferiors. On his return, he had either to shut himself up in a low and narrow cell, whence he could see nothing but a small garden a few feet square, or recommence his humble tasks. But he put up with all. Naturally disposed to devote himself entirely to whatever he undertook, he had become a monk with all his soul. Besides, how could he have a thought of sparing his body, or have had any regard for what might please the flesh? It was not thus that he could acquire the humility, the sanctity which he had come to seek within the walls of the cloister. The poor monk, oppressed with toil, hastened to employ and study all the moments that he could steal from these mean occupations. He voluntarily withdrew from the society of the brethren to give himself up to his beloved pursuits, but they soon found it out, and surrounding him with murmurs, tore him from his books, exclaiming, "Come, come! It is not by studying, but by begging bread, corn, eggs, fish, meat, and money that a monk renders himself useful to the cloister." Luther submitted. He laid aside his books, and took up his bag again. Far from repenting at having taken upon himself such a yoke, he is willing to go through with his task. It was then that the inflexible perseverance with which he always carried out the resolutions he had once formed, began to be developed in his mind. The resistance he made to these rude assaults gave a stronger temper to his will. God tried him in small things, that he might learn to remain unshaken in great ones. Besides, to be able to deliver his age from the miserable superstitions under which it groaned, it was necessary for him first to feel their weight. To drain the cup, he must drink it to the very dregs. This severe apprenticeship did not, however, last so long as Luther might have feared. The prior of the convent, at the intercession of the university to which Luther belonged, freed him from the humiliating duties that had been laid upon him. The youthful monk then returned to his studies with new zeal. The works of the fathers of the church, especially of St. Augustine, attracted his attention. The exposition of the Psalms by this illustrious doctor, and his book on the letter and the spirit, were his favorite study. Nothing struck him more than the sentiments of this father on the corruption of man's will and on diving grace. He felt by his own experience the reality of that corruption and the necessity for that grace. The words of St. Augustine corresponded with the sentiments of his heart. If he could have belonged to any other school than that of Jesus Christ, it would undoubtedly have been to that of the Doctor of Hippo. He almost knew by rote the works of Peter Dieli and of Gabriel Biel. He was much taken with the saying of the former, that, if the church had not decided to the contrary, it would have been preferable to concede that the bread and wine were really taken in the Lord's Supper, and not mere accidents. He also carefully studied the theologians Occam and Gerson, who both expressed themselves so freely on the authority of the popes. To this course of reading he added other exercises. He was heard in the public discussions unraveling the most complicated trains of reasoning, and extricating himself from a labyrinth whence none but he could have found an outlet. All his auditors were filled with astonishment. But he had not entered the cloister to acquire the reputation of a great genius. It was to seek food for his piety. He therefore regarded these labors as mere digressions. He loved above all things to draw wisdom from the pure source of the Word of God. He found in the convent a Bible fastened by a chain, and to this chained Bible he was continually returning. He had but little understanding of the Word, yet was it his most pleasing study. It sometimes happened that he passed a whole day meditating upon a single passage. At other times he learned fragments of the prophets by heart. He especially desired to acquire from the writings of the prophets and of the apostles a perfect knowledge of God's will, to grow up in greater fear of his name, and to nourish his faith by the sure testimony of the Word. It would appear that about this time he began to study the scriptures in their original languages, and to lay the foundation of the most perfect and most useful of his labors, the translation of the Bible. He made use of Reuchlin's Hebrew lexicon that had just appeared. John Lang, one of the friars of the convent, a man skilled in Greek and Hebrew, and with whom he always remained closely connected, probably was his first instructor. He also made much use of the learned commentaries of Nicholas Lyra, who died in 1340. It was from this circumstance that Pflug, afterwards Bishop of Naumburg, said, "Si Lyra non lyricet, Lutherus non saltasset." The young monk studied with such industry and zeal that it often happened that he did not repeat the daily prayers for 3 or 4 weeks together. But he soon grew alarmed at the thought that he had transgressed the rules of his order. He then shut himself up to repair his negligence, and began to repeat conscientiously all the prayers he had omitted, without a thought of either eating or drinking. Once even, for 7 weeks together, he scarcely closed his eyes in sleep. Burning with desire to attain that holiness in quest of which he had entered the cloister, Luther gave way to all the rigor of an ascetic life. He endeavored to crucify the flesh by fasting, mortifications, and watching. Shut up in his cell, as in a prison, he struggled unceasingly against the deceitful thoughts and the evil inclinations of his heart. A little bread and a small herring were often his only food. Besides, he was naturally of very abstemious habits. Thus he was frequently seen by his friends. Long after he had ceased to think of purchasing heaven by his abstinence, content himself with the poorest viands, and remain even 4 days in succession without eating or drinking. This we have on the testimony of Melanchthon, a witness in every respect worthy of credit. We may judge from this circumstance of the little value we ought to attach to the fables that ignorance and prejudice have circulated as to Luther's intemperance. At the period of which we are speaking, nothing was too great a sacrifice that might enable him to become a saint, to acquire heaven. Never did the Romish Church possess a more pious monk. Never did cloister witness more severe or indefatigable exertions to purchase eternal happiness. When Luther had become a reformer, and had declared that heaven was not to be obtained by such means as these, he knew very well what he was saying. "I was indeed a pious monk," wrote he to Duke George of Saxony, "and followed the rules of my order more strictly than I can express. If ever monk could obtain heaven by his monkish works, I should certainly have been entitled to it. Of this all the friars who have known me can testify. If it had continued much longer, I should have carried my mortifications even to death, by means of my watching, prayers, reading, and other labors." We are approaching the epoch which made Luther a new man, and which, by revealing to him the infinity of God's love, put him in a condition to declare it to the world. Luther did not find in the tranquility of the cloister, and in monkish perfection, that peace of mind which he had looked for there. He wished to have the assurance of his salvation. This was the great want of his soul. Without it, there was no repose for him. But the fears that had agitated him in the world pursue him to his cell. Nay, they were increased. The faintest cry of his heart re-echoed loud beneath the silent arches of the cloister. God had led him thither that he might learn to know himself, and to despair of his own strength and virtue. His conscience, enlightened by the divine word, told him what it was to be holy, but he was filled with terror at finding, either in his heart nor in his life, that image of holiness which he had contemplated with admiration in the word of God. A sad discovery, and one that is made by every sincere man. No righteousness within, no righteousness without. All was omission, sin, impurity. The more ardent the character of Luther, the stronger was that secret and constant resistance which man's nature opposes to good, and it plunged him into despair. The monks and divines of the day encouraged him to satisfy the divine righteousness by meritorious works. "But what works," thought he, "can come from a heart like mine? How can I stand before the holiness of my judge with works polluted in their very source? I saw that I was a great sinner in the eyes of God," said he, "and I did not think it possible for me to propitiate him by my own merits." He was agitated and yet dejected, avoiding the trifling and stupid conversation of the monks. The latter, unable to comprehend the storms that tosses his soul, looked upon him with surprise, and reproached him for his silence and his gloomy air. One day, Cuclius tells us, as they were saying Mass in the chapel, Luther had carried thither all his anxiety, and was in the choir in the midst of the brethren, sad and heart-stricken. Already the priest had prostrated himself, the incense had been burnt before the altar, the glorious sun, and they were reading the gospel, when the poor monk, unable any longer to repress his anguish, cried out in a mournful tone, as he fell on his knees, "It is not I, it is not I." All were thunderstruck, and the ceremony was interrupted for a moment. Perhaps Luther thought he heard some reproach of which he knew himself innocent. Perhaps he declared his unworthiness of being one of those to whom Christ's death had brought the gift of eternal life. Cuclius says they were then reading the story of the dumb man's cry from whom Christ expelled the devil. It is possible that this cry of Luther, if the account be true, had reference to this circumstance, and that, although speechless like the dumb man, he protested by such an exclamation that his silence came from other causes than demoniacal possession. Indeed, Cuclius tells us that the monks sometimes attributed the sufferings of their brother to a secret intercourse with the devil, and this writer himself entertained that opinion. A tender conscience inclined Luther to regard the slightest fault as a great sin. He had hardly discovered it, before he endeavored to expiate it by the severest mortifications which only served to point out to him the inutility of all human remedies. "I tortured myself almost to death," said he, "in order to procure peace with God for my troubled heart and agitated conscience. But surrounded with thick darkness, I found peace nowhere." The practices of monastic holiness, which had lulled so many consciences to sleep, and to which Luther himself had had recourse in his distress, soon appeared to him the unavailing remedies of an empirical and deceptive religion. "While I was yet a monk, I no sooner felt assailed by any temptation than I cried out, 'I am lost.' Immediately I had recourse to 1,000 methods to stifle the cries of my conscience. I went every day to confession, but that was of no use to me. Then, bowed down by sorrow, I tortured myself by the multitude of my thoughts. 'Look,' exclaimed I, 'thou art still envious, impatient, passionate. It profiteth thee nothing, O wretched man, to have entered this sacred order.' And yet Luther, imbued with the prejudices of his time, had from early youth considered the observances, whose worthlessness he had now discovered, as a certain remedy for diseased souls. What can he think of the strange discovery he has just made in the solitude of the cloister? It is possible, then, to dwell within the sanctuary, and yet bear in one's bosom a man of sin. He has received another garment, but not another heart. His expectations are disappointed. Where can he stop? Can all these rules and observances be mere human inventions? Such a supposition appears to him, at one time, a temptation of the devil, and at another, an irresistible truth. By turns contending with the holy voice that spake to his heart, and with the venerable institutions that time had sanctioned, Luther passed his life in a continual struggle. The young monk crept like a shadow through the long galleries of the cloister, that re-echoed with his sorrowful moanings. His body wasted away. His strength began to fail him. It sometimes happened that he remained like one dead. On one occasion, overwhelmed with sorrow, he shut himself up in his cell, and for several days and nights allowed no one to approach him. And therefore his troubles and his terrors led him to study with fresh zeal the writings of the prophets and of the apostles. And therefore his troubles and his terrors led him to study with fresh zeal the writings of the prophets and of the apostles.